Chapter 50. A well-built teenage boy in a soiled black leather-studded vest and black jeans was crouched in the far corner of the cellar, waiting for us. He had a crowbar. He leaped up and began swinging it over his head. He was growling. It had to be Irwin Snyder, the boy who had killed his parents. He was so damn young, just 17. What had gotten into his head? Gold fangs protruded from his mouth. Contacts made his eyes appear blood red. His nose and eyebrows were pierced with at least a dozen tiny gold and silver hoops. He was tightly muscled and over 6 feet tall. He'd been a star football player before he suddenly dropped out of school. Snyder continued to growl at us. He stood in an oozing groundwater puddle and didn't seem aware of it. His eyes were glazed and seemed to be set way back in his skull.
"Back off," he shouted. "Y'all have no idea how much shit you're in. Y'all have no goddamn idea. Now get the fuck out of here. Get out of our house."
He was still swinging the heavy rusted crowbar. We stopped moving. I wanted to hear whatever he had to say. "What kind of shit are we in?" I asked Snyder.
"I know who you are," he shouted, spraying spit all the way across the room. He was in a murderous rage. He looked stone beyond comprehension.
"Who am I?" I asked him. How could he know?
"You're fucking Cross, that's who," he said,
and bad fang-capped teeth, the smile of a madman. His answer shook me up.
"The rest of y'all are FBI dogs. Y'all deserve to die, you will. The Cross don't work here, assholes."
"Why did you kill your mother and father?" Kyle asked from his place on the stairs.
"To free 'em," Snyder sneered. "Now they're free as little birdies in the air."
"I don't believe you," I said. "That's bullshit." He continued to growl like a barnyard dog.
"Smarter than you look, Cross."
"Why did you use metal fangs when you bit them? What does the tiger mean, Irwin?" I asked another couple of questions.
"You already know or you wouldn't ask,"
he said, and laughed wickedly. His real teeth were yellow and nicotine-stained. His black jeans were filthy and looked as if they'd been dipped in ashes. The leather vest had studs missing. The cellar smelled awful, like spoiled meat. What had happened down here? I almost didn't want to know. "Why did you kill your parents?" I asked again.
"Killed them to free myself," he screamed. "Kill their asses 'cause I follow the tiger."
"Who's the tiger? What does the tiger mean?" His eyes danced with mischief.
"Oh, you'll see soon enough. You'll see. Then you'll wish you didn't."
He dropped the crowbar and reached into his jeans, and I rushed him. Irwin Snyder had a stiletto knife in his right hand. He swiped the knife at me, and I pivoted away. I wasn't fast enough, and the blade sliced my arm. It burned like hell. Snyder screeched in triumph. He lunged at me again, fast, athletic, forward. I managed to wrestle the knife from his hand, but he bit into my right shoulder. He went for my neck. Kyle and the others were all over him now. "God damn it," I yelled in pain. I punched his face. He bit me again, this time on the back of my hand. Damn, it hurt. The FBI agents had trouble pinning him down as he hurled a stream of curses and threats at all of us. They were afraid of being bitten.
"Nah, you're one of us," he screeched at me. "You're one of us. Now you can meet the tiger,"
he howled and laughed. Chapter 51. My head was aching, but I spent the next 4 hours questioning Irwin Snyder in a bare, whitewashed, claustrophobic room at a jail in Charlotte. For the first hour or so, Kyle and I interrogated him together, but it didn't work out. I asked Kyle to leave the room. Snyder was shackled, so I felt safe being alone with him. I wondered how he felt. My arm and hand were beginning to throb, but this was more important than my wounds. Irwin Snyder had known I was coming to Charlotte. How had he known? What else did he know? How was a vicious young killer in Charlotte connected to the rest of this mess? Snyder was pale and unhealthy looking, with a scruffy goatee and sideburns. He stared at me with eyes that were dark, very active, intelligent enough. Then he laid his head down on the formica tabletop, and I lifted him right out of his chair by his hair. He cursed at me for a full minute. Then he demanded to see his lawyer. Hurts, doesn't it? I said. Don't make me do it again. Keep your head off the table. This isn't nap time. It isn't a game, either. He gave me the finger, then put his head back down on the table. I knew he had been getting away with this type of shit at school and in his home for years. But not here, and not with me. I yanked him by his greasy black hair again, even harder this time. You don't seem to understand the king's English. You murdered your parents in cold blood. You're a killer. Lawyer, he screamed. Lawyer, lawyer. I'm being tortured in here. I'm being beaten by a cop. Lawyer, lawyer. I want my fucking lawyer. With my free hand, I grabbed his chin. He spit on my hand. I ignored it. Listen to me now, I said. Listen! Everybody else from the house is at the station in the city. You're the only one out here with me. No one can hear you, and you're not being beaten. But you are going to talk to me. I yanked his hair again, as hard as I could without actually pulling out a clump. Snyder shrieked, but I knew I hadn't hurt him much. You killed your mother and your father with a claw hammer. You bit me twice, and you stink to high heaven. I don't like you, but we're going to have this talk anyway.
Better see somebody about those bites, pig, he snarled. You've been warned.
He was still talking tough, but he cringed and pulled back when I reached for his hair again. How did you know I was coming to Charlotte? How did you know my name? Talk to me.
Ask the tiger when you two meet. It'll happen sooner than you think.
Chapter 52. It became clear that Irwin Snyder couldn't have committed the earlier murders. He had been out of North Carolina only once or twice in his life. Most of his contact with the outside world was over the internet, and of course he was too young to have been involved in murders going back 11 years. The 17-year-old had killed his mother and father, though. He seemed to have no remorse. The tiger had told him to do it. That was all I had been able to get out of him. He refused to say how he had come into contact with the person or group who had such control over him. While I was questioning Snyder, and then the others from the house, my shoulder and hand began to itch and then ache. The bites were puncture wounds, but there had been little bleeding. The bite to my shoulder was the deepest, even through my jacket, and had left prominent teeth marks, which I'd had photographed at the station. I didn't bother going to the local emergency room in Charlotte. I was too busy. The wound soon became extremely painful. By late morning, I had trouble making a fist. I doubted I could pull the trigger of my gun. Now you're one of us, Irwin Snyder had told me. I wondered what group or cell or cult Snyder was part of. Where was the tiger? Was it only one person? I attended a meeting with the FBI and the Charlotte police that lasted until 8 that evening. The net result was that we were still nowhere near a solution. The FBI was scouring the internet searching for messages relating to the tiger, or any kind of tiger. I flew back to Washington later that night and managed to sleep a little on the plane. Not nearly enough. The phone rang minutes after I stepped inside the front door of my house. What the hell?
You're back, Dr. Cross. That's good. Welcome, welcome. I missed you. Did you enjoy Charlotte?
I put down the phone receiver and hurried outside into the night. I didn't see anyone. No movement up or down Fifth Street. But that didn't mean he wasn't lingering near the house. How else could he know I was here? I ran out into the street. I stared hard into the darkness. I couldn't see anyone, but maybe he could see me. Someone had definitely been watching. Someone was out there. I am back, I shouted. Come and get me. Let's settle this right here now. Let's settle it. Here I am, you bastard. He didn't call back to me. Didn't answer. Then I heard a footstep behind me. I whirled around at the mastermind.
Alex, what is going on out here? When did you get home? Who are you talking to?
It was Nana, and she looked very small and frightened. She came up and hugged me tight. Chapter 53. I woke up in bad shape around 6 the next morning. There was blotchy redness and intense heat around the bites. The wounds throbbed. I noticed a nasty, pus-like drainage from the bite on my hand. It was swollen to nearly twice its normal size. This was not good. I was sick as a dog, and it was the last thing I needed right now. I drove myself to the St. Anthony's Hospital ER, where I found out that I was spiking a fever. My temperature was 103. The emergency room doctor who examined me was a tall Pakistani named Dr. Prabhu. He could have been one of the sons in the movie East is East. He said that the most likely cause of the cellulitis was Staphylococcus, which was a common bacteria found in the mouth.
How is it that you were bitten? He wanted to know.
I suspected that he wasn't going to like my answer, but I gave it anyway. I was subduing a vampire, I said.
No, seriously, Detective Cross. How did you come to be bitten?
He asked a second time.
I am a serious person, and this is a serious question. I need to know this.
I am completely serious. I am part of the team investigating vampire killers. I was bitten by a man with fangs.
Okay, fine, Detective. Whatever you say.
I was given tests in the ER. A CBC and differential count, sedimentation rate, and a culture and sensitivity test on the drainage from the wounds. Blood cultures would be studied. I told Dr. Prabhu that I needed copies of his findings. The hospital didn't want to give them over to me, but they finally relented and faxed the results to Quantico. I was sent home with a prescription for a drug called Keflex. I was to keep my infected arm elevated and administer Domboro soaks every 4 hours. I was too sick to do much of anything by the time I got home. I lay in bed and listened to Elliot in the morning on the radio. Nana and the kids hovered around me. Nausea swept over me really bad. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. Couldn't concentrate on anything except the painful throbbing in my shoulder and hand. I became delirious for several hours.
Now you're one of us.
I finally fell asleep. But I woke up around 1 in the morning. The witching hours. I felt even worse. I was afraid the phone would ring and it would be the mastermind. Someone was in the room with me. I sighed when I saw who it was. Janny was sitting in the chair by my bed, keeping watch over me.
Just like you did when I was sick last year,
she said.
Now sleep, Daddy. Just sleep. Rest up. And don't you dare turn into a vampire on me.
I didn't answer Janny. I couldn't even manage a few words. I drifted off to sleep again.
Chapter 54. No one would expect this, and that was why it was so good, so excellent. The end of Alex Cross. It was time for it to happen. Maybe it was overdue. Cross had to die. The mastermind was inside the Cross house. And it was as exciting and extraordinary an experience as he had imagined it would be. He'd never felt more powerful than he did standing in the dark living room at 3:00 a.m. He had won the battle between the two of them. The mastermind had triumphed. Cross was the loser. Tomorrow, all of Washington would be mourning his death. He could do anything. So what should he do first? He wanted to sit and think about it. No need to rush. Where would he choose to sit? Why, of course, on Cross's bench at his piano, on the sun porch. Cross's favorite spot for relaxation and escape. The place he liked to play with his children, smarmy, sentimental bastard that he was. The mastermind was tempted to play something, perhaps a little Gershwin, to show Cross that even his command of the piano was superior. He wanted to announce himself in a dramatic fashion. This was so good, so delicious. He never wanted tonight to end. But was it the absolute best he could do? It had to be a night he would never forget, something to savor always, a souvenir that would have great meaning to him, only to him. There were two triangles that explained his complex relationship with Alex Cross, and he visualized them as he sat on the porch. Biding his time, enjoying himself immensely. Christ, he was smiling like a damn fool. He was in his element, and he was happy, so happy. There were two triangles. The first, with himself at the top, tied by love to villain, his brother, and father, Alex. The second triangle, with himself at the top, tied by love to Alex's women, grandmother, girlfriends, and his brother, Alex. It was such a good psychological model, so concise and clear and sound. It explained everything that was going to happen tonight. Even Dr. Cross would approve. It was the perfect dysfunctional family triangle. Maybe he would explain it to Cross now, just before he murdered him. He slid on plastic gloves and then plastic booties. He checked the load in his pistol. Everything was set. Then upstairs he went. The caller, the mastermind, Svengali, Moriarty. He knew the Cross house very well. He didn't even need a light. He didn't make any unnecessary noise. No mistakes. No evidence or clues for the local police or the FBI to follow. What an incredible way this was for Cross and his family to die. What a coup. What a chilling idea. The killing order was starting to come to him as he climbed the stairs. Yes, he was sure of it. Little Alex, Jenny, Damon, Nana, then Cross. He walked to the end of the upstairs hallway and stood there listening before he opened the bedroom door. Not a sound. He slowly pushed on the door. What was this? A surprise? Christ. He didn't like surprises. He liked precision and order. He liked to be in total control. The young daughter, Janny, was sitting by Cross's bed, fast asleep, watching over her father, protecting him from harm. He watched Cross and the girl for a long moment, maybe 90 seconds. A small nightlight had been left on in the room. There were thick bandages on Cross's hand and shoulder. He was perspiring in his sleep. He was wounded, sick, not himself, not a worthy opponent. The killer sighed. He felt such disappointment, such sadness and despair. No, 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 this was all wrong. This wouldn't do. It was all wrong, all wrong. He slowly closed the bedroom door and then he quickly, silently retraced his steps back out of the Cross house. No one would know he had been there, not even the detective himself. As usual, no one knew anything about him. No one suspected a thing. He was the mastermind, after all.
Chapter 55. I woke several times during the night. I thought someone was in the house at one point. I felt someone there. Nothing I could do about it, though. Then I woke again after 14 hours in bed and found that I was actually feeling better. I could almost think straight again. Exhaustion still had a hold on me, though. All my joints ached. My eyesight was blurry. I could hear music playing softly in the house. Erykah Badu, one of my favorites. There was a knock on the bedroom door, and I said, "I'm decent. Who goes there?" Janny pushed open the door. She was holding a red plastic tray with a breakfast of poached eggs, hot cereal, orange juice, and a mug of steaming coffee. She was smiling, obviously proud of herself. I smiled back at her. That's my girl. What a little sweetheart she was, when she wanted to be.
"I don't know if you can eat yet, Daddy. I brought you some breakfast, just in case."
"Thank you, sweetie. I'm feeling a little better," I said. I was able to push myself up in bed, then to prop a few pillows behind me with my good hand. Janny carried the tray over to the bed and carefully set it on my lap. She leaned in and kissed my fuzzy cheek.
"Somebody needs a shave."
"You're being so nice," I said to her.
"I am nice, Daddy," Janny answered. "You feel good enough for a little company? We'll just watch you eat. We'll be good. No trouble. Is it okay?"
"Just what I need right now," I said. Janny came back with little Alex in her arms, and Damon trailing behind, giving me the high sign. They climbed up on my bed, and as promised, they were very good. The best medicine around.
"You just eat your breakfast while it's hot. You're getting too skinny," Janny teased. "Yeah, you are," Damon agreed. "You are drawn and gaunt."
"Very good." I smiled between small bites of eggs and toast, which I hoped I could keep down. I kept running my hand over little Alex's head.
"Did somebody poison you, Daddy?" Janny wanted to know. "What exactly happened?"
I sighed and shook my head. I don't know, baby. It's an infection. You can get it from a human bite. Janny and Damon grimaced. Nana says it's septicemia. They used to call it blood poisoning. Damon contributed some scholarly research. Who am I to argue with Nana, I said, and left it at that. I'm no match for Nana Mama right now. Or maybe ever. I looked at the puffed-up bandage and gauze covering most of my right shoulder. The skin was a sickly yellow around the bandage. Something bad got into my blood. I'm okay now, though. I'm coming back. But I remembered what Irwin Snyder had said.
You're one of us.
Chapter 56. I was able to make it downstairs for dinner that night. Nana rewarded my appearance at the table with chicken, gravy, and biscuits, and a homemade apple crisp. I made an effort to eat, and I surprised myself by doing pretty well. After dinner, I put little Alex to bed. I went back up to my room around 8:30, and everybody seemed to understand that I was tired. Not myself yet. I didn't sleep once I got up to my room, though. Too many bad thoughts about the murders were buzzing in my head. Right or wrong, I felt like we were getting close to something. Maybe I was just fooling myself, though. I worked for a couple of hours on the computer, and my concentration was fine. I was pretty certain that something had to link up the cities where the murders had taken place. What was it, though? What was everybody missing? I looked at anything and everything. I studied the schedules of airplane carriers that flew into each of the cities, then bus companies, and finally railroads. It was probably just busy work, but you never know, and I had nothing better to do. I checked out corporations that had main or branch offices in the cities and found there were a lot of matches, but it wasn't likely to get me anywhere. Federal Express, American Express, The Gap, The Limited, McDonald's, Sears, and JCPenney were just about everywhere. So what? I had at least one travel book for each of the cities where murders had taken place, and I pored over them until it was almost midnight. Nothing came of it. My arm was throbbing again. I was starting to get a headache. The rest of the house was quiet. Next, I checked on traveling sports teams, circuses and carnivals, author tours, rock and roll groups, and then I hit on something in the entertainment area. I had been ready to call it a night, but here was something interesting. I tried not to get excited, but my pulse quickened as I checked the West Coast information first, then the East Coast. Bingo! Maybe. I had found the kind of pattern that I was looking for. An entertainment act that worked winters and early spring on the West Coast and then came East. Their tour cities and the murders were matching up for now. Jesus. They had been touring for 15 years. I was almost certain I had found some kind of connection to the killers. Two magicians who called themselves Daniel and Charles. The same ones Andrew Cotton and Dara Gray had seen the night they were murdered in Las Vegas. I even knew where they were scheduled to perform next. They were probably already there. New Orleans. I called Kyle Craig. Chapter 57. 11 years of unsolved murders had come down to this. New Orleans, Louisiana. A nightclub called Howl. A pair of magicians named Daniel and Charles. I still couldn't travel, so I remained in Washington. I hated not being in New Orleans. I was missing an important time. But Kyle was there. I think he wanted to make this bust himself. And I couldn't blame him. This could help make his career, no doubt about it. The case was huge. That night in New Orleans, a half dozen FBI agents circulated through the crowd that had turned out for Daniel and Charles's early performance. Howl was located in the Warehouse District, off Julia Street. Usually it featured musical acts, and even tonight, Zydeco and blues reverberated from the mortar and red brick walls. A few tourists tried to bring to-go cups from Bourbon Street into Howl. They were denied admission for life. The used Cressidas and Colts and a few sports utility vehicles in the parking lot were a tip-off to the presence of Tulane and Loyola college students packed inside. Smoke lay thick over the noisy and restless crowd. Several in the audience looked underage, and the club had been cited for serving minors. The owners found it easier to buy off the New Orleans police than to effectively regulate the club. Suddenly everything went quiet. A single voice punctuated the silence.
Holy shit, look at this.
A white tiger had walked out onto the stage, which was covered in layers of black velvet. There was no leash on the cat. No trainer or handler was anywhere in sight. The formerly raucous audience remained silent. The big cat lazily raised its head and roared. A girl in a hot pink tank top screamed in the pit seating area. The cat roared again. A second white tiger walked out and stood beside the first. It glared down at the crowd and roared. The pit audience was situated directly in front of the stage. Men and women seated there scrambled away, grabbing their beer bottles. An unmistakable tiger roar now came from the back, behind the audience. Everyone froze. How many cats were loose in the club? Where were they? What the hell was going on? The blinding lights on stage made the peripheral space a dark void. Any retreat to either side of the room was a gamble. There was a shift of the stage lights, left to right, then right to left. The lights were powerful, almost blinding. The lights created the visual illusion that the entire stage had moved. The crowd's gasp was audible. Panic was in the air. The tigers were gone. Two magicians in shimmering black and gold lame suits now stood at the center of the stage where the tigers had been just a heartbeat ago. They were both smiling. They almost seemed to be laughing at the jittery audience. The taller of the two, Daniel, finally spoke.
You have nothing to fear. We're Daniel and Charles, and we're the best you will ever see. That is a promise I plan to keep. Let the magic begin.
The crowd inside Hal began to clap and cheer, and then to howl. There were two shows that night. Each was scheduled to last an hour and a half. FBI agents had infiltrated the crowd. Kyle Craig was inside. More agents were posted outside on the street. Daniel and Charles concentrated on several tricks, which they called Homage to Houdini. They also performed Carl Hertz's Merry Widow. The audience response to the shows was highly favorable. Nearly everybody left the club in awe, vowing to come again to tell friends to come. Apparently, it happened everywhere that Daniel and Charles played, coast to coast. Now came the real work for the FBI. After the second show, Daniel and Charles were whisked away to a silver limousine idling in a sealed-off alley at the stage door. There was a lot of noise and confusion backstage. Daniel and Charles were screaming at each other. Once the silver limousine finally exited the alley, a team of FBI cars followed through the usual crowds in downtown New Orleans, then out toward Lake Pontchartrain. Kyle Craig was in radio contact for the entire trip. The limo pulled up in front of an antebellum mansion where a private party was in full rage. Loud rock and roll music, Dr. John, blared across spacious lawns marked by 200- and 300-year-old oaks. Partygoers had spilled onto the lawns that sloped down to the dark, glimmering water of the lake. The limo driver got out and opened one of the back doors with a theatrical flourish. As several FBI agents watched in disbelief, two white tigers jumped out. Daniel and Charles were not in the limousine. The magicians had disappeared.
Chapter 58. Daniel and Charles had arrived at a small private club inside a house in Abita Springs, Louisiana, about 50 miles outside New Orleans. This particular club had never been written up in the entertainment section of the Times-Picayune, or in any of the glossy covered guide magazines available in the lobbies of just about every large and small New Orleans hotel. A man named George Halenga greeted his guests with great excitement and enthusiasm. Halenga had badly pitted cheeks, the thickest black eyebrows, dark, sunken eyes. He wore contacts that made his eyes appear black. Halenga weighed more than 300 pounds, all of it bunched tightly into a black leather jacket and pants purchased at a big and tall shop in Houston. He bowed to the magicians as they arrived and whispered that he was honored by their visit.
You should be, Charles snapped. We're tired after a long day. You know why we're here. Let's get on with it.
Off stage, Charles often did the talking, especially if it meant addressing someone like this pathetic underling, this cipher, George Halenga, who immediately showed Daniel and Charles the way downstairs. They were the masters. He was the slave. There were legions of others like him, waiting in so many cities, praying for a chance to serve the sire. As he descended the steps, Daniel broke into a smile. He saw the captive, the slave, and he was well pleased. He went to the boy, who looked to be 18 or 19, and spoke to him. I'm here now. It's so good to meet you. You're astonishing. The boy was tall, perhaps 6'2". He had closely cropped blonde hair, supple limbs, full lips that were accented with the most delicate silver rings. His lips were rosy red, outstanding. He's pouting. He looks so sad. Let him loose, Daniel commanded the slave Halenga. What is the poor boy's name?
His name is Edward Haggerty, sire. He's a freshman at Louisiana State. He is your servant, said George Halenga, who was now visibly trembling.
Edward Haggerty's slender hands were manacled to the brick wall. He wore silver thong underwear, a silver ankle bracelet, nothing else. He was a magnificent creature, slender, toned, perfect in every way. George Halenga stole a nervous look at the sire.
He might run if we let him loose, sir.
Daniel reached out his arms to the beautiful boy and held him tenderly as he would a small child. He kissed his cheek, his forehead, and those astonishing red lips. You won't run away? He asked in a soft, soothing voice.
Not from you, the boy answered just as softly. You are the sire, and I am nothing.
Daniel smiled. It was the perfect answer.
Chapter 59. My phone rang early in the morning, and I snatched it up. It was Kyle. In his slow and deliberate voice, he told me that Daniel and Charles had disappeared the previous night. He was furious at his agents. I'd never heard him so angry. So far, no murders had been reported that night in and around New Orleans. About 6 that morning, the magicians had showed up at their house in the Garden District. Where had they been all night? What had happened? Something had. I stayed in Washington that day, still recuperating from the cellulitis. I studied Daniel and Charles and wrote a preliminary profile on them to compare with the one being done in Quantico. The first important bit of information was that the magicians had definitely performed in Savannah, Charleston, and Las Vegas. I was working with a couple of techies in Quantico, and they not only matched up the magician's tour with about half of the murders, but verified that Daniel and Charles had definitely performed in those cities and were there when the murders had taken place. Another useful nugget was that the Tigers traveled with Daniel and Charles only for booking dates that lasted at least a week. The magicians were scheduled to perform in New Orleans for the next 3 weeks. They also owned a house there in the Garden District. I shared what I had found with Quantico, and they put it into the file they were amassing. I also faxed everything to Jamila Hughes in San Francisco. She was trying her best to get down to New Orleans, but her boss hadn't made a final decision yet. I put in another call to Kyle on the matter. He hemmed and hawed, but finally promised to see if he could get Inspector Hughes sprung for a few days. After all, it had started with her case. I was becoming frustrated at home. I felt as if I were on a stakeout in my own bedroom, with nothing to observe firsthand. The consolation was that I was with little Alex for long patches of the day, and that I got to see more of Damon and Janie. But I was feeling a little like the forgotten man on the murder case. I went to see Dr. Prabhu at St. Anthony's that afternoon. The doctor examined me, then reluctantly gave me clearance to go back to work. He told me to take it easy for the next few days.
How did you get those bites? He asked again. You never told me, detective.
Yes, I did, I said. Vampires in North Carolina. I thanked the doctor for his help, then went home to pack for a trip to New Orleans. I was a little unsteady, but I couldn't wait to get there. Nana didn't bother to give me the business when I left Washington this time. She was angry because I'd been so ill from the infected bites. I flew into New Orleans International Airport that afternoon, then I took an old yellow cab to the Big Easy. A message was waiting at the front desk of my hotel, which was the Dauphine Orleans. I opened the small envelope hesitantly, but it was good news. Inspector Hughes was on her way to New Orleans. The message was classic. It was pure Jamila. I'm coming to New Orleans, and they're going down. Don't doubt it for a second. Chapter 60. Jamila and I met up at the Dauphine Hotel that night. She was decked out in a black leather jacket, blue jeans, a white pocket tee. She looked rested and ready for anything. I didn't feel so bad myself. We had supper together, steak and eggs and beer, in the dining room. As always, I enjoyed her company. We made each other laugh. At 10:30, we drove over to Howell. Daniel and Charles had shows scheduled at 11 and 1. And then, maybe they had planned another clever disappearing act? We were pumped to take them down. Unfortunately, we still needed concrete evidence that they were our killers. There were more than 200 agents and New Orleans police involved in the case. Something had to break. Presumably, Daniel and Charles would have to feed soon. It was a Friday night, and Hal was almost full when we got there. Loud music played from speakers that seemed to be everywhere in the ceilings and walls. The crowd was mostly young and restless, drinking beer, smoking, dirty dancing. Several goths were mixed in with the more clean-cut college kids. The two groups leered at each other, and the atmosphere was charged. A photographer from Offbeat magazine crouched in front of the stage, waiting for the magic show to begin. Jamila and I sat down at one of the small tables and ordered beers. There were at least a dozen FBI agents in the club. Kyle was outside in a surveillance car. He had been inside the night before, but it was hard for Kyle to blend in with a mostly young, hip crowd. He looked too much like a cop. The back of my throat was already beginning to burn from all the smoke and the heavy perfume in the air. A gulp of beer soothed the gullet somewhat. My arm and hand still ached from the bites. My head was clear, though. I definitely felt a lot better than I had. I liked having Jamila around again. She gave good counsel. Kyle has a 6-team surveillance on the magicians around the clock, I told her. They won't lose them again. Kyle guarantees it. The FBI thinks they're definitely the killers? She asked. No doubt about it? Lock them up, throw away the key? Some doubt, I suppose, but not much. You never know exactly what Kyle is thinking, I told her. But yes, I think he does. The techies at Quantico do, so do I. She studied me over the lip of her bottle of beer. Sounds like the two of you are pretty tight, huh? I nodded. We've worked a lot of cases together in the past few years. Our success rate is good. I can't say that I really know him. I've never had much luck working with the FBI, she said. That's just me, though. Part of my job is to make sure police relations with the Bureau run smoothly in D.C. Kyle is definitely smart. He's just hard to read at times. She sipped her beer slowly. Unlike somebody else at this table. Unlike two somebodies at this table, I corrected her, and we both laughed. Jamila glanced toward the stage. What's the holdup? Where are they? Should we start stamping our feet for them to come out and show us some magic? Show us what they've got? We didn't have to. A moment later, one of the magicians walked out onto the stage. It was Charles, and he looked like a killer. Chapter 61. Charles was wearing a skin-tight black bodysuit and thigh-high patent leather boots. He had a simple diamond earring and a gold nose stud. He stared contemptuously at the audience. He did this for several uncomfortable moments, his eyes full of hatred and disdain for every case he encountered. At least twice, I thought that he looked directly at Jamila and me. So did she. Yeah, we're watching you too, asshole, she said, raising her beer in mock salute. You think those two pitiful creeps know we're here? Who knows? They're good at this. They haven't been caught yet. I hear you. Hopefully they both have stomach cancer and will die slowly and painfully over the next several months. Cheers. She raised her bottle again. Charles leaned down and spoke to a college-age couple at a table near the stage. He was mic'd. What are you two airheads staring at? Watch out, or I'll turn you into a couple of toads. Upgrade you on the food chain. He laughed, and it was deep and throaty. To my ear, it was also unnecessarily unpleasant, way over the top.
The kids in the audience laughed and cheered him on. Civility seems to be dead at the moment. Nasty is chic. Nasty is so cool and real. I looked over at Jamila. He sees them as food. Interesting how his twisted mind works. The second magician sauntered out onto the stage a couple of minutes later. No magic gimmicks to announce the entrance, which surprised me. I had heard this was a real light and sound show, but not tonight. Why the style change? Was this for us? Did they know who we were? For the uninitiated, I'm Daniel. Charles and I have been doing magic shows since we were 12 years old and living in San Diego, California. We're very good at magic. We can do the Vanishing Performer, Houdini's personal favorite, the Sword Cabinet, Carl Hertz's Merry Widow, DeColta's Cocoon. I can catch a bullet fired from a Colt Magnum in my teeth. So can Charles. Aren't we special? Don't you wish you were us? The crowd howled and cheered. The rock music from the speakers had been lowered. Only the beat droned on. The illusion you are about to witness is the same one Harry Houdini used to close his show in Paris and New York. We're using it to open our show. Need I say more? The lights suddenly flashed off. The stage was in total darkness. A few women in the audience screeched loudly. Mock fear. Mostly there was laughter, some of it nervous. What were these two really up to? Jamila nudged me with an elbow. Don't be scared, I'm right here. I'll protect you. I'll remember that. Then tiny pinpricks of light appeared everywhere on the stage. The main spots came on again. Nothing happened for the next minute or so. Then Daniel, riding a spirited, prancing white stallion, came out on the stage. He was dressed in royal blue glitter from head to toe. He wore a matching top hat, and he tipped it to the cheering audience. I must admit, this is pretty cool, Jamila said. Quite the stunt, so visual. Now what? Daniel was followed on stage by 8 men and women in crisp white palace uniforms, and 2 white tigers. It was a pretty amazing spectacle. 2 female performers held up a huge oriental fan in front of Daniel and his high-stepping horse. My eyes were glued to the stage. Jesus, Jamila muttered. What the hell is this? They're ripping off Harry Houdini, like the man said, and they're doing it well. When the 2 women slowly pulled the fan away, Daniel was gone. Now Charles was seated on the white horse. Once again, Jesus, said Jam. How do they do that? Somehow Charles had changed into black trash and glitter. The smirk on his face was totally, incredibly arrogant. It showed utter disdain for the audience, but they seemed to love it, to love him. A puff of smoke, and the audience gasped as one. Somehow, Daniel was back on stage, standing alongside Charles and the beautiful horse. The illusion was masterful. Everyone in the audience jumped up and clapped wildly. The screams and piercing whistles hurt my ears. And that, Daniel announced, is only the beginning. You ain't seen nothing yet. Jamila looked at me, and her mouth sagged. Alex, these guys are very good, and I've seen Siegfried and Roy. Why are they playing at these little clubs? Why are they wasting their time here? Because they want to, I told her. This is where they look for prey. Chapter 62. Jamila and I watched both magic shows that night. We were amazed by the calmness and the confidence exuded by Daniel and Charles. Following the second show, the magicians went home. The agents on surveillance there said it appeared the 2 were home for the night. I didn't get it, and neither did Jamila. Eventually, around 3 in the morning, she and I returned to the Dauphine. 2 FBI teams would stay near Daniel and Charles's place until morning. We were becoming frustrated and confused. We had a lot of manpower working their butts off. I wanted to ask Jamila up for a beer, but I didn't. Too complicated for right now. Or maybe I was just getting chicken shit as I got older. Maybe I was even a little wiser. Nah. I was up again at 6, making notes in my hotel room. I was learning some things I didn't want to know, and not just about magic tricks. I now knew that in the vampire underworld,
The area surrounding the main home of a sire, regent, or elder was known as the Domain. The FBI and the New Orleans police had staked out the neighborhood in the Garden District where Daniel Erickson and Charles Defoe lived. The house was located on LaSalle near 6th. It was gray stone and probably had as many as 20 rooms. The house sat on a hill with a high, reinforced stone outer wall similar to the outer curtain of a castle. It also had a large, deep cellar, which wouldn't have been possible in the swampy sea-level terrain without the elevation of the hill. No one on the task force would admit that they believed in vampires, but everyone knew that a series of brutal murders had been committed and that Daniel and Charles were the likely killers. Jamila and I spent the next 2 days surveilling the house, the Domain. We worked double shifts and nothing could relieve the tedium. A scene that sometimes comes to mind when I'm on stakeouts is the one in the French Connection. Gene Hackman standing out in the cold while the French drug dealers eat an elaborate dinner in a New York restaurant. It's like that, just like that. Sometimes for 16 or 18 hours at a stretch. At least LaSalle Street and the Garden District were pretty to watch. The sugar and cotton barons of the mid-19th century had originally called this home. Most of the 100 and 200-year-old mansions were beautifully preserved. The majority were kept white, but a few were painted in Mediterranean pastels. Placards informing the frequent walking tours about the esteemed residence were affixed to intricate wrought iron fences. But it was still surveillance, even sitting side by side with Jamila Hughes. Chapter 63. During the stakeout on LaSalle Street, she and I found that we could talk about almost anything. That's what we did through the long hours. The topics ranged from funny cop stories to investments, movies, gothic architecture, politics, then on to more personal subjects, like her father, who had run out on her when she was 6. I told Jamila that my mother and father had both died young from a lethal combination of alcoholism and lung cancer, probably depression and hopelessness, too. I worked for 2 years as a psychologist, hung out a shingle, I told her. At the time, not too many people in my neighborhood in D.C. could afford treatment. I couldn't afford to give it away. Most white people didn't want to see a black shrink, so I took a job as a cop. Just temporary. I didn't expect to like it, but once I started, I got hooked. Bad.
What hooked you about being a detective, she wanted to know.
She was a good listener, interested.
Do you remember an incident? Any one thing in particular?
As a matter of fact, I do. 2 men had been shot down in Southeast, which is where I live in Washington, where I grew up. The deaths were written off as drug-related, which meant not much time would be spent investigating them. At the time, that was SOP in D.C. Still is, actually. Jamila nodded.
I'm afraid that it is in parts of San Francisco, too. We like to think of our city as enlightened, and it can be, but people out there are good at looking the other way. It makes me sick sometimes.
Anyway, I knew these 2 men, and I was almost certain they weren't involved in selling drugs. Well, they both had jobs at a small local music store. Maybe they smoked a little weed, but nothing worse than that.
I know the types you're talking about.
So I investigated the murder case on my own. A detective friend named John Sampson helped. I learned to follow my gut. Found out that one of the men had been dating a woman who a local drug dealer thought he owned. I kept digging, following my instincts, digging a little deeper. Turns out the dealer had murdered the 2 men. And once I solved that case, it was all over for me. I knew I was good at it, maybe because of all the psych training I'd had, and I liked making things right. Or maybe I just liked being right.
Sounds like you have some balance in your life, though. The kids, your grandmother, friends, she said.
We let it go at that. Didn't pursue the obvious, that Jamila and I were both single and unattached. It had nothing to do with our jobs. If only it were that simple.
Chapter 64. One comforting reality of police work is that you rarely come up against a murder situation that you've never seen or heard about before. These killings were different. Seemingly random, vicious, ongoing for more than 11 years, varying modi operandi.
What made the case particularly difficult was the possibility that there were several killers. I met with Kyle that following morning to talk about the case. He was in a foul mood, and I couldn't wait to get out of there. We shared our pet theories and whiny complaints. Then I rejoined Jamila Hughes on the stakeout in the Garden District. I brought a box of Krispy Kremes, which got a major chuckle from her and also from the FBI agents watching the house. Everybody clamored for the tasty air-shot donuts, though. The entire box was gone in a matter of minutes. "Turns out they're real homebodies," she said as she munched on a glazed. "It's still daylight. They're probably in their coffins," I said. She grinned and shook her head. Her dark eyes sparkled. Not exactly. The shorter one, Charles, was working in the garden out back all morning. He's certainly not afraid of the sun. So maybe Daniel is the real vampire. The sire. He's supposed to be the force behind the magician's act. Charles has been on the phone a lot. He's setting up a party at the house. You'll love this. It's a fetish ball. Wear your favorite kinky things. Leather, rubber, goth, Victorian, whatever you're into. What are you into? She asked. I laughed, thought about it. Mostly denim corduroy, a little black leather. I have a leather car coat. It's a little beat up, but it's nasty looking. She laughed. I think you'd look dashing as a gothic prince. Well, how about you? Any fetishes we should know about? Well, I'll admit to owning a couple of leather jackets, pants, one pair of long boots that I'm still paying for. I am from San Francisco, you know. A girl has to keep up with the times. Same for us boys. It was another long day of surveillance. We continued to watch the house until dark. Around 9 o'clock, a pair of FBI agents dropped by to relieve us. "Let's get a bite," I said to Jamila. "Bad choice of words, Alex." We both laughed a little too hard. We didn't want to venture too far from the magician's house, so we settled on the Camellia Grill on South Carrollton Avenue at the River Bend. The Camellia looked like a small plantation home on the outside. Inside it was a neat diner, with a long counter and stools screwed to the floor. A waiter in a crisp white jacket and black tie served us. We ordered coffee and omelets, which were light and fluffy, and about the size of rolled-up newspapers. Jamila had a side order of red beans and rice. Went in the big easy. The food was good, the coffee even better. The company was nice, too. She and I got along well, maybe even better than that. Even the lulls in our conversation weren't too uncomfortable, and they were infrequent. A friend of mine wants to find love as finding someone you can talk to late into the night. Pretty good. "Nothing on the beeper," she said, while we loitered over our coffee after the meal. I had heard there were lines outside the Camellia during lunch and dinner, but we had caught a slow time. I wonder what the two of them do inside that big, eerie house, Alex. What do psycho murderers do in their spare time? I'd studied enough of them. There was no set pattern. Some are married, even happily if you ask spouses. Gary Sinise had a little girl. Jeffrey Schaefer had 3 children. That's probably the scariest thing I can imagine. When a husband or the person next door or dad turns out to be a stone-cold killer. It happens. I've seen it. She sipped her coffee refill. The neighbors seemed to like Daniel and Charles. They considered them eccentric but pleasant, and, I love this, civic-minded. Daniel owns the house. He inherited it from his father, who was also eccentric, a portrait painter. Rumor has it the magicians are gay, but they're often seen in the company of young, attractive women. Vampires aren't restricted by gender. I learned that from Peter Weston, I said. These two are equal opportunity killers, males and females. Something still isn't matching up for me, though. There's a logic hole I keep trying to fill. A few of them, actually. Their magical mystery tour sure matches up with a lot of the murders, Alex, she said. I know it. I can't dispute the evidence we've collected so far. But you have one of your famous feelings. I don't know about famous, but something feels wrong to me. This thing isn't tracking right. The other shoe hasn't dropped. That's what worries me. Why did they get sloppy all of a sudden? They went undetected for years, and now several dozen FBI agents are watching their house.
We drank our coffee and lingered in the restaurant, which was only half full, but would be humming again when the bars closed. Nobody pressured us to leave, and we weren't in a hurry to get back to the boredom of the stakeout. Jamila was interesting to me for a lot of reasons, but the main one was probably that I saw so much of my own experience in hers. We were both committed to police work. We had full lives, friends and family. And yet, in a way, we were loners. Why was that?
You okay?
She asked. Her eyes communicated concern. I usually can intuit good people, and she was one of them. No doubt about it. I just went away for a minute, I said. I'm back now.
Where do you go when you take these little mind excursions?
Florence, I said. It's probably the most beautiful city on earth. My favorite, anyway.
And you were just in Florence, Italy?
Actually, I was thinking about some of the similarities in our lives. She nodded.
I've thought about it, too. What the heck is to become of us, Alex? Are we both doomed to repeat the same mistakes?
Well, hopefully, we're going to catch two real bad killers here in New Orleans. How's that?
Jamila reached over and patted my cheek, and then she said ruefully, That's what I think, too. We are doomed.
Chapter 65. The mastermind watched Alex Cross get out of the car. He had him in his sights. Cross and the lovely inspector Jamila Hughes had returned from a dinner break and were back on surveillance duty. Were they getting closer? Would Alex and Jamila become lovers in New Orleans? That was an obvious flaw in Cross's character. He needed to be loved, didn't he? But now Cross was out of the car again. Something is bothering the great Cross. Maybe he needs to walk a little after the meal. Or maybe he needs to think about the case some more and wants to be alone. He is a loner, just like I am. This was amazing. This was no good. He followed Cross down a dark side street filled with modest homes of two styles, the double shotgun and the Creole cottage. Both were staples in this part of New Orleans. The fragrance of honeysuckle, jasmine, and gardenias was heavy in the air. He sucked in a breath. Pleasant. 100 years before, the scents had masked the odors of the nearby slaughterhouses. The mastermind knew his history, knew lots about most things, and the facts flowed easily through his mind as he continued to follow Cross at a safe distance. He retained information and knew how to use it. He could hear the rattle and hum of the St. Charles Avenue streetcar as it raced along its tracks a few blocks away. It helped to cover any slight sound of his own footsteps. He was enjoying this walk with Cross immensely, and he thought that maybe this would be the night. Just the idea sent adrenaline pumping through him. He continued to move closer to Cross. Yes, this was it. Right here, right now. He partly expected Cross to spin around and look at him. That would be good, so rich, ironic, fitting. Proof of Cross's instincts, and that he was a worthy adversary. He ducked into some lurks, and he circled. He was only a few yards away from Cross now. He could close the distance in an instant. Cross came to a stop at the old Lafayette Cemetery, the so-called City of the Dead. Inside the gates were lavish, above-ground vaults, multi-burial graves. The mastermind stopped as well. He savored this, second by second. A New Orleans Police Department sign was posted on the gates, patrolled. The mastermind doubted that was true, though, and it didn't really matter, did it? He could eat the NOPD for lunch. Cross looked around, but he didn't see the mastermind in the shadows. Should he jump him now? Would they fight hand to hand? It didn't matter. He knew he would win. He watched Alex Cross breathe. His last breaths on Earth? What a thought. Cross turned away from the cemetery and started down another side street. He was heading back to the surveillance car, to Inspector Hughes. The mastermind started forward, but then he turned away. This wasn't the night that Cross would die. He had taken mercy, spared him. The reason? It was too dark on this street. He wouldn't be able to see Cross's eyes when he died.
Chapter 66. Something surprising happened the next morning. It was an event I don't think any of us was expecting. I wasn't, and it threw me for a complete loop. We had gathered at the FBI's New Orleans office for the morning briefing. There were about 30 of us in a large and sterile room that looked out on the muddy brown Mississippi River. At 9 o'clock, Kyle addressed the surveillance team that had been on the watch during the previous 24 hours. He finished with them and went on to the day's assignments. He handed them out and was very specific. It was a typical Craig performance. Clear, to the point, efficient. Never a mistake or the hint of one. When he was finished, or thought that he was, a hand shot into the air. "Excuse me, Mr. Craig. You didn't mention me. What am I supposed to do today?" It was Jamila Hughes, and she didn't sound happy. Kyle was already collecting his notes, shuffling a few papers into his thick black briefcase. He barely glanced up as he said, "That's up to Dr. Cross, Inspector Hughes. Please see him." The remark and his delivery were unnecessarily curt, even for Kyle. I was taken aback by his rudeness, or at least the lack of any tact.
"This is complete bullshit." Jamila rose from her seat. "It's unacceptable, Mr. Craig. Especially that irritating blasé tone of yours."
The FBI agents in the room looked at her. Usually no one dared confront Kyle on anything. After all, he was rumored to be in line for the director's job someday. Moreover, many of them felt he deserved it. He was certainly smarter than anybody else in the Bureau. He also worked harder than anyone I knew.
"Look, this is no reflection on Detective Cross," Jamila went on. "But my work in California helped open this case up. I don't want anybody's pat on the back, no condescending applause, thank you, but I came all the way here and I can contribute. So use me and respect me. By the way, I couldn't help noticing there's only one other woman on this entire task force. Don't bother to make excuses," she said, and waved off anything Kyle might have been ready to say in his defense. Kyle kept his cool. "Like the supposed vampires, Inspector Hughes, gender doesn't matter to me. I do applaud your efforts during the early stages of this case, but as I said, you can see Dr. Cross about your assignment, or you can go back home right now if you like." "Thank you, everyone," he said as he saluted the team. "Happy hunting. Hopefully today will be our day." I was surprised, mostly by Kyle's response, but also by Jamila's quick anger. I was uneasy when she came up to me after the meeting. "He got me so mad. Grr," she said and shook her head and made a face. "I have a bad temper sometimes, but he was wrong. There's something fucked up about that man. I have a bad feeling about him. Why would he have it in for me? Because I'm working with you? So what do we do today, Dr. Cross? I'm not leaving because he's a goddamn idiot."
"He was wrong. I'm sorry about what happened, Jamila. Let's talk about what we do next."
"Don't be condescending," she said.
"I'm not. Why don't you get off the soapbox, though?" She still wasn't over her bad scene with Kyle.
"He doesn't like women," she said. "Trust me on that. He also practices the 3 C's that some men are so fond of. Compete, criticize, control."
"So, tell me what you really think about Kyle, and men in general." Jamila finally managed to smile.
"I think, and I'm being pretty objective and measured about this, that he's a total control freak and a complete asshole, your so-called friend. As for men, it varies with the individual."
Chapter 67. The real vampires had arrived, and they believed they were invincible. William and Michael knew that the exotic city of New Orleans belonged to them from the instant they crossed the bridge. They were a couple of young princes with their long blonde ponytails, black shirts and trousers, shining leather boots. Their mission ended here if all went well, and it would. William drove the Red Cross van through the French Quarter. They were on the lookout for prey. The van went slowly back and forth on Burgundy, Dauphine, Bourbon, Royal, Chartres, all the more famous streets. The sounds of Ready, Sex, Go blared from the tape deck. Supernatural Blonde, then Radio Tokyo.
The brothers finally got out and strolled along Riverwalk. They turned into the Riverwalk marketplace, and it made William physically ill. Banana Republic, Eddie Bauer, The Limited, Sharper Image, The Gap. Mediocrity, tripe, utter stupidity everywhere he looked.
What do you want to do? William turned to Michael. Look at all this commercial crap in the middle of this beautiful city.
Let's take somebody out here in their putrid shopping mall. Maybe we should feed in a changing room at the Banana Republic. I love that idea.
No, William said. He grabbed hold of Michael's arm. We've been working too hard for this. I think we need a distraction.
They couldn't take any more prey. Not now. Not so close to where Daniel and Charles had their domain. A distraction was definitely needed. So William drove out of New Orleans along the Bonnet Car Spillway. He continued on Interstate 10 into the real Louisiana. William found what he wanted about an hour outside New Orleans. The rock climb wasn't much, but at least the face was steep. You had to concentrate. If you didn't, you fell, and you were dead. The brothers chose to free solo, the most extreme version of the sport, also the most dangerous by far. In free solo, the climbers used no ropes or any other kind of backup protection.
We are a couple of hard men, Michael laughed and shouted once they were halfway up the 200-foot climb.
Hard men were the toughest climbers of all. They were the best, and it fit the brothers' self-image.
Yes, we are, William shouted back to his brother. There are old climbers, and there are bold climbers.
But there are no old bold climbers, Michael roared with laughter. The climb turned out to be more challenging than it had looked. It required lots of different skills. They had to do vertical crack climbing, then suddenly they were face climbing, pressing tight against the rock, using very small handholds.
We're in the climbing groove now, Michael screamed at the top of his lungs.
He had forgotten about hunting for prey, forgotten his hunger. There was nothing but the climb now, nothing but staying alive, survival of the fittest. Suddenly, they had to commit. They were at a point in the climb where once they made the next couple of moves, they couldn't go back the way they had come. There was nothing to do but go straight up, or quit right now.
What do you think, little brother? You make a plan for us. You decide. What does your instinct tell you?
Michael laughed so hard he had to grip the rock face with both hands. He looked down, and what he saw was certain death if he fell.
Don't even think about quitting. We won't fall, brother, not ever. We're never gonna die.
They climbed to the top, and from there they could see New Orleans. It was their city now.
We're immortal. We'll never die, the brothers shouted into the wind.
Chapter 68. I stared out at the great sweeping live oaks. Then I noticed the plump magnolias and sloppy fanning banana trees of the garden district. There was nothing else for me to do. The surveillance continued. Jamila was starting to repeat herself. We both were, and that became a running gag between us. Sections of the day's Times-Picayune were all over the back seat of the car. We had read it cover to cover.
There's no physical evidence tying Daniel or Charles to a single murder. Not in any of the cities, Alex. Everything we have on them is circumstantial or theoretical. Hypothetical bullshit. Does that make any sense to you? It doesn't to me.
She was probably talking just to talk, but she was making sense.
It just doesn't add up. They can't be that good. No one is.
We were parked 4 blocks north of the house on LaSalle. The Domain. We could get there in seconds if anything developed, but so far nothing had. That was the problem. Daniel and Charles rarely left their 200-year-old mansion, and when they did, it was only to go shopping or to a fancy restaurant downtown. Not surprisingly, they had good taste. I tried to answer Jamila's question. It makes some sense to me that we can't link them to the early murders. You know as well as I do. Once a murder case gets old, it's almost impossible to find witnesses or compelling evidence. I don't understand why we haven't found anything on the recent murders, though.
That's what I'm thinking, too. We have witnesses in Las Vegas and in Charleston. but no one recognizes photos of Daniel or Charles. Why not? What are we missing?
Maybe they don't commit the actual murders themselves, I said. Maybe they used to, but not anymore.
Don't they want to feast on the kills, drink the blood? What other purpose do the murders serve? Are they symbolic? Is this part of some arcane mythology? Are they creating a new mythology? Jesus, Alex, what the hell are these two monsters doing?
I didn't have answers to her questions or my own. No one did, unfortunately. So we sat in the car, tried to keep cool in the heat, and waited for Daniel and Charles to make their next move. If they were so careful and so good, then why did we know about them? Why were we here?
Chapter 69. William found this laughable. God, it was good. Priceless. He was watching the police as they in turn watched the House of Horrors owned by Daniel and Charles. It was too much. The young prince walked down LaSalle, puffing on a cigarette, haughty, confident, unafraid of anyone, superior in every way he could imagine. Michael was sleeping, so he had decided to take a stroll. This was rich. Maybe he would see one of the local celebrities who lived in the Garden District. Like the fabulous Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, or some asshole from MTV's Real World house in the Big Easy. There were two nondescript Lincolns parked on the street. He wondered if the magicians had noticed the cars. He smiled, shook his head. He wondered what the hell Daniel and Charles were thinking. They would be careful, of course. They had been committing murders for a long time, years and years. So now what? Something had to give. He continued to the end of the block, then walked south. Most of the houses here had screened-in porches crawling with vines. Along the way, he saw a fine physical specimen, a male, 21 or so, shirt off, pecs gleaming with sweat. That picked up his spirits. He was hosing down a silver BMW convertible, the James Bond car. His chiseled body, the spurting water hose, and the shiny car turned William on like a light switch. But he controlled himself and walked on. And then, just down the street, he saw a young girl. She was maybe 14, sitting on her front porch, gently stroking a Persian cat. She was pretty, even sultry. The girl had long brown hair that flowed down to her small breasts, a diaphanous snakeskin print top over a belly-length tank top. Tight, dark blue jeans, hip-hugging and flared just right. Stud and hoop earrings, both gold and silver. Toe rings, bracelets of multiple colors on one slender arm. A typical teenager, except that she was so stunning. A complete turn-on, and arrogant, just like he was. William stopped and called out to her. "Your cat is beautiful," he said, and smiled wickedly. She looked up, and he saw that she had the same piercing green eyes as the Persian. The girl ran her eyes all over him. He could actually feel her gaze against his skin. He knew that she wanted him. Men and women always did. "Why do you hold back?" he asked, and continued to smile. "If you want something, then you should take it. Always. That's your lesson for the day, free of charge." "Oh, and you're a teacher?" she called from the porch. "You don't look like any teacher I've ever had." "A teacher, but also a student." He had desire for this girl. Not only was she a beautiful physical specimen, she had good instincts. She was sexual and knowing for her age. She used her gifts, unlike most young people, who wasted their talent and potential. She wouldn't speak again, wouldn't even smile, but she didn't look away either. William loved her confidence, the way her bright green eyes tried to mock him but couldn't quite do it, the way she thrust her small breasts at him, her only weapons. He wanted to go up on the porch and take the beautiful girl right there, bite her, drink her, spill her blood all over the whitewashed wooden planks. No, not now, not yet, not here. God, he hated this, hated not being himself. He wanted to exercise his power, to use his gifts. Finally, William began to walk away. It took all his will, all his power to leave this beautiful prize sitting so invitingly on the porch. It was then that the girl finally spoke again. "Why do you hold back?" she called and laughed pitilessly. William smiled, and then he turned around. He walked back toward the girl. "You're very lucky," he said. "You've been chosen."